Welcome to this episode of the Cyber Guy Podcast. I'm your host, retired FBI Supervisory Special Agent Darren Mott. In this episode, I'll talk a variety of cyber topics with fellow retiree Supervisory Special Agent Donna Peterson, most recently of the San Francisco Field Division. But before I get to the interview, let me start with a couple cybersecurity news items, really one of note, to be quite honest. This is the end, or actually October 31st was the end of Cybersecurity Awareness Month. During that whole month on LinkedIn, I posted an article a day on some particular cybersecurity piece of information, be it ransomware, be it incident response, why a company should have incident response, why technology doesn't work necessarily, password security, things like that. If you'd like more information on those, feel free to go to my LinkedIn profile, LinkedIn/IN/DarrenMott, all one word there, the Darren Mott. And you can see those if you're so inclined. If you like, I actually took all those and condensed them into a single document. It kind of has the parts that I mentioned and the article that I referenced in each one of those articles. If you'd like a copy of that just for your own information, I'm happy to send that to you. Just send me an email, darren@thecyberguy.com. Cyber is spelled C-Y-B-U-R. And I will send that to you as soon as I can. I'm probably going to take that and do something with it in the sense of making an educational type of course to offer out in the future. So if that's something you might be interested in or your company might be interested in, let me know and we'll see about getting that to you. Let's talk about one of the key things I talked about at the end of Cybersecurity Awareness Month, and that was a FBI DHS Intel bulletin that came out regarding Russian ransomware that was targeting healthcare systems. And what this particular Intel note said, or at least instructed healthcare institutions on how to protect themselves, what to look out for, and the severity of this particular type of ransomware. No sooner did I post that day, but at least two hospital systems that I'm aware of got hit by this ransomware that day. One was the University of Vermont Medical Center, and one was St. Lawrence County Health Systems in upstate New York, which is personal to me because that's where I grew up. I had my appendix taken out there when my dad was sick. That's kind of where he went to the hospital. And so St. Lawrence County Health Systems, specifically Potsdam Canton Hospital, are very important to me in the sense of my upbringing and my life experiences. And so, unfortunately, they got hit with that particular ransomware. They claim particularly they didn't lose any financial information. Hard to tell. This particular ransomware does steal personally identifiable information, including financial data. So it's hard to tell exactly what was taken. My guess is it's probably more severe than they necessarily mentioned. But I say all this just to be aware that it's very easy to be hit with ransomware. It's not just health systems that are being targeted. It's individuals, it's other companies. And so it's very important to be aware of these intelligence briefings when they come out. If they note particular ways to protect yourself from the ransomware, what to look for, how to get it off your system, we're getting to the point where ransomware is outstripping the technology capable to prevent it. So it's going to be an ongoing problem. It's $1 billion+ a year industry for organized crime, and several billion dollars, actually, if I was to be frank. And that and business email compromise are the two biggest cybercrime issues that we are dealing with all over the place. So that was one of the last things I noted. A couple other things I noted were companies should have an incident response plan, should have a forensics plan, should have an intelligence report. But again, like I mentioned, if you'd like to see all of these articles, I'm happy to send them to you. I mentioned password security, which I've mentioned on this podcast many times. I will not revisit that here. So my guest today is a fellow retired FBI Special Agent Donna Peterson, and Special Agent is just one of the titles she held while she was with the FBI. She was a Supervisory Special Agent, Unit Chief, Assistant Section Chief, Acting Section Chief, Assistant Legal Attaché. Did I miss any other ones there, Donna? Have I hit all the titles you possessed?
Wow, that was a lot. Probably the only other one is Right Squad Supervisor and Detailee. Right.
Well, Supervisor Special Agent, that falls into that. And Detailee, I don't know what that is. That's just like a made-up term for people that got to stick somewhere for a year or so. So let's talk a little bit about your background. Where did you go to school? How did you join the Bureau? And what were you doing before you got to your new agent class at Quantico?
Sure. First of all, it's good to talk to you, Darren, and thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Oh, let me step back a second. I meant to say this, and I didn't write out my intro. I kind of made that up off the fly. One thing I wanted to make sure I said was Donna was one of my supervisors at headquarters, and she is by far the best supervisor I ever had at FBI headquarters. So I just wanted to make sure I put that in there. So.
Oh, thank you. You're very sweet, and I didn't even pay you to say that. I appreciate it. Well, like you said, cyber is an issue that's near and dear to my heart, right? So I really appreciate being able to talk about this today. So let's see, what was I doing before the Bureau? I was actually a Russian linguist in the Air Force before joining the FBI, right? I joined the military almost right after high school. So I went to college using my GI Bill benefits at the University of Maryland. And while my ex-husband and I were stationed in Misawa, Japan, and we got back to the U.S. in like 1998, and I applied to the FBI and went to Quantico in 1999 when I was 28.
So you were class, because I went 99 as well, you were 99, what was your new agent class number, 99 what?
9916.
I was like, so you were 6 weeks ahead of me. I was 9919. So actually we would have.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, so we would have crossed paths or overlapped, but we wouldn't have known that obviously because we went different directions until 2007. We ended up at FBI headquarters under the guidance of one Ray Gergen. Fabulous. We'll talk about that on a different podcast perhaps, but so talk about after new agent class, where was your first assignment, and then where did that lead you? And you can kind of, we're going to talk about the different places you worked for the Bureau because you have been all over the place. But if you want to kind of give a quick rundown of where you started, where you got to, and where you ended up, and then we'll kind of delve into what you did cyber-wise at each of those places.
Okay, sure. Oh man, let's reach back into the old memory stores. Okay, so Los Angeles was my first office, right? When I got there, of course, because I was a Russian linguist, right, with a national security military intelligence background, they put me right into counterintelligence. But honestly, I was bored, right, because that was not what they sold to you at Quantico, mm-hmm. but what the Bureau was supposed to be. So as soon as I could, I actually moved over to a white collar squad. Which is how we worked cyber back then, right? Because cyber wasn't even a division. It wasn't really its own standalone violation, because someone during my probationary time was working a lot of cyber cases, intellectual property rights cases, things like that, and I became interested in it. So for most of my time in LA, I worked criminal cyber.
Let me ask, was it transnational? Right, was it a NIPSI squad?
It wasn't even a NIPSI squad.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah, gotcha. It was still a white collar squad, although it was the NIPSI program.
I think yeah, headquarters. Gotcha. Okay. Okay.
Right. When the Bureau still owned it. Mm-hmm. So we worked transnational computer intrusions, insider threats, and a lot of online fraud. Although I have to say insider threats were by far my favorite thing to work. So, and from there, when I met you, I went to have FBI headquarters, right, to manage parts of our criminal cyber program. My focus was on transnational cybercrime and attacks on the U.S. financial infrastructure, right? And from there, because we had worked a lot with overseas issues, right, cybercrime is global, I moved over to our international operations division, where I worked on putting our first cyber assistant legal attachés overseas in Bucharest, Tallinn, Kiev, and The Hague. And then I took a posting myself as the assistant legal attaché in Canberra, Australia, but I handled national security issues while I was there, counterterrorism, counterintelligence, and counterproliferation, not cyber. So I then came back to the U.S. to manage a counterterrorism squad, a joint terrorism task force in Oakland, California. And that was in 2014. So in 2015, I started my master's degree in cybersecurity policy. So near the end of 2016, I took a temporary duty assignment to U.S. Cyber Command as the FBI liaison to JTF ARIES, which was absolutely fascinating. And also because of my degree, I became really interested in working cybersecurity policy. So in 2017, I took an 18-month assignment back to headquarters in our Congressional Affairs Office. And from there, I was detailed to the Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee, focusing on national security and cybersecurity policy, which was also another absolutely fascinating assignment, probably one of the most intense but most fun things that I ever did in the Bureau. We worked a lot on election security issues, right? Everything from technical challenges to foreign influence. We also did a lot of oversight related to federal agency cybersecurity, right? From FISMA oversight, which is the Federal Information Security Modernization Act of 2014, and to specialized issues like the Equifax data breach and its effect on, you know, like the IRS contract, things like that. So after that, I went back to Oakland and took over a Russian counterproliferation squad that focused in part on addressing the foreign threat to emerging technologies, right? Quantum computing, AI, biotech, which obviously San Francisco is sort of a hotbed of innovation for those things. But true to my interests, like that, I went back to headquarters for 2 months over the summer of 2019 to be our deputy CISO, which was eye opening to say the least.
And probably eye opening things in there we probably shouldn't talk about here.
Absolutely not. And then finally, right, the San Francisco office decided to create a second cyber criminal squad in San Francisco because our original cyber criminal squad obviously was in San Jose, right, closer to Silicon Valley, closer to Mountain View. So I, of course, asked to run it because I wanted to get back to my cyber sort of operational roots. So I spent my last bit of time in the bureau standing up our new criminal cyber squad in San Francisco and, of course, also dealing with the Twitter hack that happened over the summer.
Oh, yes, yes. Good times. All right. So we're going to delve into a lot of that as we go forward. So that's a good overview of your career. Quick 21 years. So you did 21 years. Yeah, 21. Yeah, you lasted a year longer than I could. But you had to, though, right? You had to get to, yeah, you were forced to.
Because I joined at 28.
Right. So obviously Russia has been in the news freaking since 2016. And you, as you mentioned, you worked a lot of transnational and Russian focused. And for the FBI, cyber in the early 2000s, it was all about Russia. Russia was always the big problem. They were all the malware makers. You know, could we trust Kaspersky? All that kind of stuff. And when we met at FBI headquarters, the way that cyber division was designed at the time, there were really just two investigative units, and they split up the country in half. And so we had half the country. The other unit had the other half. And one of the things that we started doing towards the end was these things called threat focus cells, which were let me ask you this. I wasn't involved in the creation of the threat focus cells, although I had one. How would you define threat focus? You are able to define that better than I am. So what is a threat focus cell? Let's start with that before we get into what my question was going to be.
I don't know. We essentially, a threat focus cell was exactly what it sounded like, right? Like we had a malware threat focus cell. We had a Russian threat focus cell, and whatever it was that the FBI defined our mission priority to be, right? And whether it was malware, right, like the actual creation and the actual technical aspects of malware, or the criminal cyber threat emanating from Russia, right? We just sort of put together a threat focus cell so we would make sure that our mission priority was that thing, right? And that's what we worked on. That's what we applied most of our resources and efforts towards.
Right. And then during that time, the cyber division split off a little bit into a national security focused section and a criminal section, and the Russian organized cybercrime task force stayed on the criminal side largely because it was criminally oriented, if you will, even though obviously there's a national security issue to that. But so we had the Russian organized crime threat focus. So you dealt a lot with Russia. How have you seen, and I'm throwing you a curveball here because I didn't send you this question. It kind of came to me as I was sitting here, but how have you seen the Russian threat from a cyber perspective evolve from when you were a Russian linguist in Air Force, right? Really to where we are now. You don't have to go every year how it changed, but how have you seen that evolve from your first introduction to it to what we did at headquarters to probably where we are today?
Gotcha. So I will say, here's the thing to me, and obviously, right, let's go all the way back. I was still in language school, right? I was still at the Defense Language Institute when the Berlin Wall fell. So I spent a lot of my career in the military with senior linguists telling me about the bad old day, right? Bad old days when the Cold War was really cold. But despite that, like Russia as an adversary has been a pretty consistent theme throughout my career. So to your point, I don't think you can talk about the evolution of the Russian cyber threat without talking about the evolution of the U.S. and Russia political relationship, right? And what I mean by that is, at least to me, the interesting thing to me about Russia is that the antagonistic relationship that we have is personal. Right. I mean, it's more so than some of the other country conflicts that we have. Right. Some of those are economic. Some of those are power. But our conflict with Russia is personal. And if you remember, Putin said in 2005, I think, that he considered the breakup of the Soviet Union to be the greatest political catastrophe of the 20th century. And if you couple that, right, with Russia's repeated requests to NATO to not allow the countries bordering Russia, right, like the former Soviet bloc, to join NATO, which NATO just rejected, right? Most of those countries were NATO members between by 1999, 2004, right? Something like that. You get a pretty toxic political and security stew, right? I mean, NATO was sort of an existential and military and security threat to Russia, and of course, right? The U.S. was right there. I mean, Russia blames us for the erosion of their national power and influence, and we've added insult to injury by leading like international efforts to hold Moscow accountable for its annexation of Crimea and its attacks on Ukraine, right? So to me, the cyber threat has evolved right along with this, because any way that Russia can sow chaos and discontent, right? In any way that they can take shots at the U.S., right, they're going to. Because, again, right, from their view, we have caused them a lot of pain. Mm-hmm. So, like if you fast forward to today, right, and the election interference and the disinformation campaigns, right, they start to make more sense. Like, do you remember the weirdness in 2017 with the CalExit and, like, the Texas National Secession Movement?
Yeah.
Right. Those both had deep ties to Russia, right? Mm-hmm. Like, Russian troll farms were like oxygenating the idea of breaking up the United States, right? Yep. And to me, I see that as retribution for the breakup of the Soviet Union, right? Sure. And barring a total breakup, the next best thing is violent chaos and civil unrest, because that's what they suffered through during the breakup of the USSR. Right. And to me, this makes a lot of sense if you put it in context. And cyber is just sort of, right, one more arrow in that quiver that Russia can use to do damage.
Right. And I did some history learning on my own about Russia's political interference history. And it goes back to 1690 or 1610, targeting Poland. So, I mean, do we really believe that they weren't trying to do something in 2000 and 2004 and 2008 and 2012? They just didn't have the technology to do it. Now they do.
Right. No, absolutely. And remember, and I think we've talked about this too, right? It's a very common concept when you're talking about cyber threats and even cyber warfare, right? This becomes an asymmetric issue, mm-hmm. right? Because you can have a country take some serious punches, and they can land pretty hard at you, and that country does not have to be your economic or military equal to do so.
Right. So I'm going to throw a curveball question on based on that statement right there. So I interviewed a friend of mine from high school who's in the Air Force, and she said, mm-hmm. we are doing cyber warfare now. Do you agree with that?
100%. I'm a huge fan of David Sanger, right? If you've read his mm-hmm. book, The Perfect Weapon. And one of the things he says is we are in a constant low grade cyber warfare right now, right? Like that's just where we are. And in fact, I told you, right, I was at Cyber Command in 2016, right, when they were still, you know, sort of getting their legs underneath them. You know, some of the first operations were happening then. I mean, they're operating now under an executive order from 2018, I think, that's allowing them to be a lot more aggressive in cyberspace. And I think that's a reaction to the reality that we are, in fact, in a constant low-grade cyber warfare situation now.
Well, then I would like to say that in 2008 and 2000 or 2007 to 2009, when we created the Russian threat focus, so we were starting that conflict right there. We began, that's where it began, with our thought process that we should try to get with these Russians because we know all the problems coming from Russia and see if they can help us out. Then I will say for me, I got three trips to Russia for it. I got to see the Hermitage in St. Petersburg and I got a helicopter ride over St. Petersburg, and I made some good Russian friends who we'd, you know, ate Georgian food and drank a lot of vodka and really accomplished little else. So there at least was that.
I do remember, right? We put a good effort in to attack the problem sort of at its core, right? And see if we could deal with some international cooperation, at least on the criminal side.
But we did get two restitution checks for American Express and Apple. The one time they came over here, they brought us restitution. So we did have an accomplishment there. So since we're talking international cooperation, you obviously went to IOD, the International Operations Division within the FBI, and made your way to Australia as an assistant legal attaché. So you must have some experience with how, you know, we always see what the U.S. is doing from a cyber perspective, but what are other countries doing? How are they doing it differently? Are they doing it better? Are they dealing with the same problems? What does that look like from an international perspective?
Yeah. Okay. So while I was in IOD, my time was split sort of half and half. I was the Eurasia unit chief, and then I was the Europe unit chief, right? So there was a chance to see quite a broad range, you know, at least within Europe, right, of cyber issues. So, and remember, like way back there when I was in IOD, like cybercrime laws in other countries were all over the map, right, from almost non-existent to laws prioritizing different issues than we have, right? And nothing was easy in cyber because everyone had, like there were issues, like there were different forensic standards, and then there was a lack of dual criminality, right? Mm-hmm. As you know, if you're going to have some, you know, mutual legal assistance from another country, the thing that you're calling a crime in your country has to be a crime in that country as well, right? So you can sort of exchange information based on dual criminality. And if you don't have a cyber law that's applicable, right, to a U.S. law, or we did, or vice versa, we didn't have one that was applicable right to that country, then there was a problem, right, exchanging information. Broadly, like even now, right, I think the cyber landscape is still all over the map. Like when you look at the EU's focus on privacy-led legislation through the GDPR, while the U.S. has no federal equivalent, right, like just California's Consumer Privacy Act, meanwhile, the U.S. is finally holding antitrust hearings about big tech and wrestling with free speech issues and social media, while multiple other countries are now really getting into that discussion about decryption and data access concepts, right? Which was a big deal for us a few years ago. I mean, not that we've solved it. Our attention is focused on other cyber issues. But I will say, and I'm sure you remember this, we did have a good amount of international cooperation and general goodwill to work together on cybercrime, right? So we did what we could, which included a lot of technical training and consultations about how the FBI handled cybercrime. Like that could have very well been the beginning of my love of policy. But, you know, in general, countries were willing to address the problem. They just often didn't have the capability or legal framework to do so, right? Like it was just a tough landscape because it was a new landscape. And everyone was still sort of trying to get their head around like what global cybercrime, like what the global cyber threat meant.
Yeah, and I think one of the best conferences I think I ever attended, it was you, me, and Susan Forensic, the Strategic Alliance Conference in London. That one, in 2008. It's funny because I went back to that in 2011, I want to say. Yeah, I was back at headquarters in counterintelligence, and I had to force my way onto which cyber was going over there to talk with the Five Eyes partners on the on cyber and counterintelligence matters. And I was the cyber counterintelligence unit chief, and they didn't invite me, so I forced my way into that trip, much to the chagrin of the unit chief of the cyber squad or cyber unit there. And it was not as seemed to be as organized in that perspective. And then it kind of changed over time. I don't really think my last eight years, I didn't hear a lot about the Strategic Alliance at all. I mean, they would have a conference every once in a while, but I don't know if they were accomplishing much. And it seemed like that was a good approach to take from a partner perspective that didn't seem to take off, and maybe have a different perspective on that.
Right. No, it was, but you're right. I mean, I chaired the cyber subgroup, right, of the Strategic Alliance for a while, right, which was an alliance between the Five Eyes countries, right, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, the UK, and the US, really to, like I said, on the cyber criminal side to sort of get some of this stuff done. And if you remember, some of the projects we worked on were, I mean, we had the legal summit in Denver, right, where everybody brought their sort of legal teams. We brought our OGC, our general counsel, right? So we could actually talk about the on the ground issues that we needed to get past, right? To really work as a unified coalition. We did the same thing with forensic standards. And we also, I do remember one of the funny things that we just kept going round and round and round about was how to measure your effect on cybercrime. Like, how can you tell it's effective, right? Like, how can you tell when crime goes down on the internet? It was really...
It was only 5 right? billion this year. It was 5.2 billion last year. Success.
Right? Exactly. But to your point too, there were a lot of strong personalities sort of driving that alliance, mm-hmm. right? And then I don't know what happened to it when I moved to IOD.
So you spent time in Australia. I'm not going to ask you anything cyber wise in Australia because you didn't work it, mm-hmm. but I do want to know. One of the things you sent me when you first were on your way over there was a sheet of paper with all the bugs and animals you needed to avoid because they'd kill you. So let's talk about that for a second. Was it really that bad? And then how often did you see those kind of bugs?
That's right. Yes. Yeah. So I remember. So obviously, right, when you go overseas, you know, the FBI has an agreement with the State Department. The State Department handles your housing, right? It handles a lot of things for you, right? They're essentially your sort of full service landlord when you go overseas. And I remember when I got my apartment issued to me, right, the State Department welcome package had a 3-page front and back, right, list of all of the deadly spiders and bugs in Australia. So they were like, you know, if you see one of these, it's very poisonous, if not extremely deadly. So, I mean, at that point, I just decided whatever it is I see, if it's smaller than me, I'm going to kill it. And that's it.
And how many did you run across? Did you see any?
It was nuts. Well, so actually, yes, one of the funniest things for for Americans there. In fact, we actually had a delegation come from the U.S. And I remember we were out to dinner at a very fancy restaurant in Sydney, and we were on the water, right? The restaurant was all glass on one side, and the sun was going down. And one of the Americans, right, one of the FBI agents in our delegation looked up and saw this monstrous spider, which is about 7 inches, right, long from top to it's a huntsman spider. Actually, they're very right. I don't know if they're liked in Australia, but they're fine, right? They don't do any damage. They sort of, you know, they just live in people's houses and hang out, and they're fine. And it just caused mass panic at that table underneath the spider. And I do remember. So right before I got there, right. President Obama came to visit Australia, and he stayed in the ambassador's residence, right? And the ambassador's two children had actually adopted a huntsman spider that lived in the corner of their room. Oh. And again, these things are 6-7 inches long. I mean, they're huge, right? And the ambassador's kids had to write a note. They wrote a note and put it underneath the spider, and they said, "Dear Secret Service, please don't kill the spider." Right? Like, his name is Joe. he's one of our pets, so really he's fine. So yeah,
very nice.
Well, it was a great assignment. Australia is a fantastic, fantastic country. I'd go back in a heartbeat.
Did you get to tour? Like, did you walk about and go out and see where Crocodile Dundee grew up and all that stuff? Or
well, so you'd be surprised, right? Australia is actually the FBI's largest area of responsibility, right? In the entire organization. Right. I mean, we covered New Zealand, which has its own office now. Fiji, Papua New Guinea, right? Christmas Island, like the AOR was absolutely huge. I want to say I did 22 travel vouchers my first year there. Right? It was actually hard to get your own vacation time in, right? Yeah. Because I covered all those same issues with New Zealand as well, right? So I was in New Zealand all the time. And it's a lot like, right, when I used to talk to my Australian liaisons, and they were like, okay, we're going to have 3 weeks in the U.S. and we want to see Los Angeles and Chicago and New York, and we want to go to Miami and also see the Grand Canyon, right? Yeah. Like you just can't do that in 3 weeks. It was the same thing, even living in Australia, right? The continent is as big as the continental U.S. There was just a ton to see there, and New Zealand and everything else. But I saw as much as I could in between all the work we were doing.
And you loved it, I'm sure, correct?
I did. I absolutely loved it.
That is where you and I differ. I would go travel on international trips. I could not wait to get back. I hated the food, hated the TV, and the Diet Coke tasted like crap. So, yeah.
I do remember.
Yeah. You had to sign some of those vouchers yourself. So, yeah, so you brought up President Obama. So let's move into politics a little bit. Not that either of us are in politics, but it is election day. We're recording this podcast. So you mentioned you spent time on Capitol Hill as the FBI representative to the House. How well is cyber being addressed by the Senate? I'm sorry. Oh, even better. Okay. So how well is cyber being addressed by our leaders? Do they know what they're doing? Are the staffers talented? Are we screwed all the way to Sunday?
So I will tell you, right? Like one of my favorite things about being in the FBI is the sheer talent that we have, mm-hmm. right? We have some amazing and some amazingly capable people in the Bureau, right? And it is an honor and a privilege to work with them and to know them. I would say it's the same thing for Hill staffers, right? I mean, they are altruistic, and they are driven, and they really and truly genuinely care, right, about the issues they work on. Right. It's not. And it was unbelievable. And they are whip smart too. Right. It was an unbelievably impressive place to me to work for that. Right. When you talk about the actual human talent there.
Sure.
One of the problems, though, right, is sort of our institutions and our incentives are they're either wrong or they're calcified or they're outdated. Right. There it's really despite all of that. Goodwill and talent and effort, it is really, really hard to get things done for all of the reasons that it's always hard to get things done in government. As far as cyber too, and I will tell you, there were some things that I didn't understand and I didn't think through and I didn't realize until I got to the Hill. So we can kind of talk about the cyber issues in two parts. One of them is the unsexy governmental affairs side, and then the other part is the sexy side, like you're talking about, right? Election mm-hmm. interference and,
sure, yeah.
You know, modernization. So first, one of the things I didn't even realize until I got to the committee is right, the Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee. The GAC side, the Governmental Affairs Committee, his GAC has broad jurisdiction over government operations, right? And this includes the cybersecurity of federal agencies, right? Including reviewing FISMA and Government Accountability Office IT and cybersecurity reports, like, which my committee was happy to let me help with, because most people would rather stick a fork in their eye than read these reports, quite frankly.
Right.
Right.
And you read it, edited it, and sent it back to them on how to write it better, correct?
I didn't. Oh my God, I loved it. I couldn't get enough. At some point, I had so many FISMA reports in my inbox. I was like, I can't read these fast enough. I love them. Yes. But being a policy nerd, yes, I found them fascinating. But this is the issue, right? It, like, in the broadest strokes, like, because the government invested so heavily in technology and automation, like in the 60s and 70s and 80s, we have tons of legacy systems throughout the government, right? Mainframes, outdated custom software, coded in obsolete languages, right? Like, our tax code still runs on COBOL, right? Like, it's ridiculous. I mean, you know, we have mainframes in the bureau that we still haven't retired. Super clunky desktop CPUs, right? Old peripherals. And like, and as the years go by, the cost of maintaining these systems just keeps increasing, right? So the money Congress doles out to agencies for technology mostly gets spent on maintenance. Right. Like, the government spent $96 billion on federal IT in 2018. And I'll bet you 70% of that was on maintaining legacy systems. Right? Like, no government agency gets enough money to maintain their systems, to continue to provide services, and modernize. Right. The money right now is going to patch and pray, like, versus massive system overhauls. Right. I mean, for example, like, the IRS is still running critical systems from the Eisenhower administration. that's like the late '50s. Right. Like, it's magnetic tape. Anyway, that was something to me that was really shocking. Right. They're really. And here's the thing. There are a lot of people in government who recognize this problem. But, you know, maybe Congress doesn't give an agency quite enough money. And there's also, I think you mentioned this in an earlier podcast, there's a talent problem, right?
Sure.
Federal CIOs, they have an average tenure of about 2 years, right, versus 4 years in the private sector. Like, that is not enough time to become familiar with systems, implement meaningful changes, right? The Government Accountability Office says you need at least 5 to 7 years to see some of these major, major changes and upgrades through. And nobody sticks around long enough to do it.
It's the frustration problem. You can exactly, identify all your issues. You can say, here's how much it's going to cost to fix it. And then you get a note back from the Senate saying, this is all great. We see what you're saying, but we need you to cut 10% because you know, we're on a continuing resolution for 8 months. So,
Right. No, exactly. Also that, right? You know, there's not enough funding. There's not timely funding. And there's also, too, there's an issue. The Office of Personnel Management has put out directive after directive after directive instructing agencies to give their CIOs and CISOs the right authority to get this done. Mm-hmm. And that means budget review, purchase review. But, you know, it's government. People don't like to give up that power. So it just doesn't happen. And it just becomes a blip in a report year after year after year.
So I guess we're lucky that it's only. I guess we're lucky that China's only hit OPM at this point.
As far as we know.
As far as we know, right? Yes. Exactly. Right. So here's let me ask you a question about the staffers. So you mentioned the staffers were very talented and very motivated. Do they get burned out just as quickly? That's an interesting question that I've thought of. That, you know, if you're a staffer, God bless you that you're willing to do that, to put up with those idiots up there. But yeah, and like you said, they're smart. They're willing to do the right thing. But how and this is getting apart from the cyber a little bit, but just out of curiosity, because you were there, how quickly do they get burned out?
Well, I tell you, right? They grab their staffers young, right? So they're young and enthusiastic. But also, one of the things I didn't understand: Hill staffers have the same retirement structure that we do.
Oh,
right, the 1.7 multiple. Right, and the 20 years, right, of federal service. Which is nice, right?
Wait, hold on. Like, step back a second. They only have to do 20, or they have to do
Well, no, they have the same thing, right? They have the 1.7 multiple like we do, just like federal law enforcement for 20 years.
Sure, but they—I
mean, they can certainly do more than 20.
But are they eligible to get it at 20?
Oh, that's a good question.
Yeah, I would assume they'd have to go 30 to be eligible, but still, 30 times 1.7 is a pretty good deal.
Exactly. I don't know. I don't know if they could get it after 20 years, but then they have to wait to draw it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? 5762. I'm not actually sure of, right? But their benefits are pretty good. But you're right. It's the same thing as being in the FBI, I think, right? Like, the that being there, right, so close to, right, the power and this, the decisions making, right, running the most powerful country in the world is incredibly addicting, but it's also exhausting.
Sure. Yep.
Right. Mm-hmm. So there, and like I said, and it's hard. And again, and it's really hard, right? If you're the opposite party
oh, to right.
the current
sure.
administration,
yeah.
right? Yep, like, yep. like it's just that much more frustrating to try to get things done.
Well, I promise we wouldn't talk politics. We'll get off of this topic. But that was a very interesting insight into all of that. So, jumping ahead to your last posting in San Francisco, I know you were there, then you went back to headquarters, and you went back to Silicon Valley. So let's talk about Silicon Valley, because you mentioned a little bit of this to me beforehand. But so you got to see Silicon Valley up close and personal. Tell us about the tech giants that most of us, what do you know about the tech giants that most of us don't know? Are they the ultra geniuses that have created fabulousness for all of us, or what are we looking at here?
So fabulous. Where are you not just going to sit on Twitter tonight for the next?
I'm not. Twitter is a cesspool of misery. I got rid of it a couple weeks ago. I haven't gone back. I will not be on Twitter. I don't have an account. Oh, I'm taking three Tylenol PMs and going to bed. That's what I'm doing. I'm not. Anyway.
Oh, okay. So this is what I'd say, and especially right. I spent the last 6 years of my career in right being connected to San Francisco and working in San Francisco. Like, of course, like just like what you just said, right? The story or idea that people have about Silicon Valley and the big names in tech is one of like some scrappy, talented founders creating a product or service that the world didn't know it needed, right? And making billions of dollars as their creations just come to life. Like in my experience, like, and remember too, I was also in San Francisco, right? And not down south in San Jose, right? The landscape is a lot more varied than that, and also like much, much quieter. Like most startups or tech firms are people, are things people have never heard of, right? But here's the biggest issue that I saw there. The one thing that they all have in common, whether you've heard of them or not, right, is a laser focus on survival and growth. Because what's the point of doing anything else if you cease to exist as a company, right?
Sure.
Totally logical. So, like, understandably, almost nothing else matters in their race to survive, expand their name recognition, market share, and unless they're in an industry with existing government regulations like finance, right? Other than that, it's just a big free-for-all. So because of this growth mindset, right, companies don't pay a lot of attention to the security of their digital infrastructure early on. And that includes the actual, right, organic design of their platforms or products, right? They're not built to eliminate or reduce manipulation, exploitation, or fraud, right? Like this leaves them unbelievably vulnerable to both technical intrusions and product or service exploitation, right? Like, I don't really have an answer for this, because I totally understand the mindset that causes companies to end up in these situations. But like in my little cybersecurity world, like I would love to see cybersecurity become a positive market differentiator, right? And what I mean by that is like consumers and users of products would actually choose to use products and services that have cybersecurity versus those without,
right?
Which actually gives people a market incentive to not just design secure infrastructure, but to actually, you know, to price in cybersecurity from the beginning, because it is part of this survival mindset, if that makes sense.
Yeah. So I'm guessing they are not taking the CIA triad into account when they're first starting up. They're not so much concerned about they're probably concerned about the confidentiality, but as far as the, you know, availability and the integrity, do our best to protect it.
I would say some people aren't even thinking about cybersecurity at all, right? One of the things that I always used to say when I was out speaking, doing public speaking, and let me tell you, it fell flat every single time, was that I would prefer people to think of themselves as a technology and a, right, as a technology company and an online company first before whatever their job is,
yeah,
right, before whatever their actual company is. And of course, right, if you're a small restaurant, if you're a CPA firm, if you're a small law firm, if you're a small science and tech startup, right, they want to do this thing that they have a passion for.
Sure.
Right.
Yep.
And this thing, like some of them, I mean, they don't even, I mean, early on, it might just be six people sitting around a room deciding to incorporate, are deciding to press this thing and see if they could get some funding and you know, and again, make their creation or their idea come to life. I mean, I've you know, in my calls with victims and public speaking, I mean, I've seen all kinds of things. I've seen people use Gmail for most of their, right? for yeah. most of their work. They haven't even incorporated their own domain type thing. Really, really just scrapped together things. And I will say when companies start to mature, right, about their digital infrastructure and everything, it's all about marketing.
Right.
Marketing and outreach and constant contact and right. recurring revenue and like all of that, right. It's that aspect of technology, not the security part. And because again, right. By the time I talk to them, it's usually too late. Right.
So they don't have the NIST cybersecurity framework up on a poster on the wall saying, let's make sure we got these 180 controls covered.
Exactly. It turns out they don't even know what NIST is.
Yeah. Right. Exactly. So now I will say this.
And I will say,
go ahead.
Well, let me say too, and I need to, you know, I need to be fair here as well. I also talked to quite a few, you know, CIO consortiums, CISO consortiums. They are well aware, right, of the problems and the challenges they're facing. And they're well aware of the gap between where their company is and where they need to be, mm-hmm. right? Like, absolutely. Some of these, you know, slightly larger, a little bit more mature companies have started thinking about cybersecurity. They've got some really talented people there. It is still a matter of resources and funding and attention and commitment, right? To this thing that nobody really understands except for the nerds in the back. Right. You know, there was a certain amount of frustration there too. It's like I said, I don't want to give the impression that there are people, right? Anyone who works IT in San Francisco, they absolutely know what they're doing, right? Yep. But again, everything is sacrificed on this altar of growth.
So let me ask you this question. You mentioned the Twitter hack earlier. I'm not going to ask for details on that, obviously. But so we hear about that. Twitter gets hacked. You hear about that. Apple gets hacked. You'd hear about that. So there's a lot of, you know, small tech firms out there, like you said. How often were you guys getting called with people saying, hey, we got a problem, you know? I mean, I assume you got the insider every once in a while and, hey, this guy stole our whatever database. But I've got to believe there's a lot of nation state activity out there, too, that's never going to make the news. And you don't have to get into specifics, obviously. But how often were you guys getting those calls? Hey, we got a problem. Come help us out.
So I will tell you, we had 6 cyber squads in San Francisco. I was not handling nation state issues.
Gotcha. Okay. So, okay.
I was doing cyber criminal, right?
Yep.
So I will say there were plenty, but that was not me, right? We had other supervisors who focused on those. But I will say for me, right, I did a lot of victim management, victim notification, things like that. But it just for me, it was ransomware and business email compromise all day long.
Sure. And did a day go by that you didn't get a call on one of those two things?
Nope.
See, that is
never,
and that is impressive.
Never.
And let me ask this question. When you went out to do a victim notification, well, how many times did you have to go do a victim notification where you were the first point of contact where they knew they had a problem?
All of my victim notifications were like that.
That's great. Right.
But I will say, and I did hear you talk about the frustration of victim notifications on one of your earlier podcasts. And I think that comes from your counterintelligence sort of framework.
Yeah. A little
right?
different. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. For us, well, I will say for the Bureau, the victim notifications that I was doing was normally when someone else in the FBI, right, working some other ransomware variant started to see reconnaissance and was able to, right, and was able to say, this system is getting hit, or they're about to get hit, right? Or we see these files being loaded onto this hospital's network or this law firm's network or whatever, right? So for me, I was always in a pretty good position when I did victim notifications or my agents did victim notifications, because we could say, listen, this is what's happening. These are the files. This is what you need to look for. And this is how you need to, right? And this is how you need to protect your system going forward.
Did they ever question that you were actually with the FBI when you called them?
Yes.
And so let me ask this question. This happened here in Birmingham where our cyber squad did a victim notification to a company because we saw from a source from another case that they were a target of a ransomware group. The files were being loaded. We knew what they looked like. We told the company, here's what it is, here's how to take it off. The CIO didn't believe me when I said, yep, that's a cyber agent in the Birmingham division. Didn't believe the supervisor of the cyber squad when he sent her an email that said, here's how you get this off your system. She then decided that it would be best to get confirmation from the special agent in charge of Birmingham, sent an email internally to the special agent in charge, came in the next morning, the ransomware had been deployed.
that's fantastic.
Yeah. So good times. So you and me have been watching this. You know, we were both doing cyber before the FBI even had a cyber division. So we've seen it evolve over 20 years. So now looking ahead 20 years, how do you see it evolving from where we are now to where we're going to be?
Oh boy. You know, that is a great question, Darren, because let me tell you, I would not have guessed, right, in the early 2000s when we were up to our necks in online fraud and hacking and
DDoS.
Extortion.
Oh, like, I got a DDoS attack.
DDoS, yes, DDoS. That we would be where we are now, right, in terms of social media manipulation, polarization, exploitative algorithms, ransomware, business email compromise, right? And again, as David Sanger says, this persistent low-grade cyber warfare. I mean, you remember social media wasn't even a thing, right? When we started working cyber.
Those were the days.
Those were the days when all we had was auction fraud.
Right, exactly. Someone stole my World of Warcraft stuff.
Exactly. So, I mean, so ultimately, this is what I think, right? This is the Donna Peterson solution to, you know, cybercrime threats as we see it, as I see it. Like, I think we need as much of a global consensus as possible on the responsible collection, use, and protection of sensitive data, mm-hmm. right? And we also need a broader definition of what sensitive data is, right? That's not just PII. Right, personally identifiable yep. information. Mm-hmm. This is consumer behavior, right? This is intellectual property. This is location data, right? This is biometrics, everything, right?
Sure.
And again, I think right, we're going to collect it. Like that ship has sailed, mm-hmm. right? It's going to be collected. Nobody is going to unroll the collection, which is where I see a lot of the privacy legislation coming back. They're trying to unroll the sort of way the world works now, and I don't think that's practical. So we really need to focus on the responsible collection, use, and protection of data. Like without that, like I see an incredibly dystopian future, right? At least for some areas of the world, right? Sure. It involves constant biometric and location surveillance, suppression of dissent, government misconduct, the use of discriminatory and predatory algorithms, right? To create and maintain a permanent underclass, mm-hmm. destabilize governments and societies. And for straight cyber criminal activity, right? I see death by a thousand cuts. Like advanced digital societies are slowly bled dry from ransomware and VEC attacks, right?
Yep.
We cannot arrest or investigate our way out of these problems. Like we need legal, regulatory, political, and diplomatic frameworks, right, to manage these issues globally.
Yeah, and unfortunately, leaders everywhere aren't focused on these issues. I mean, you and I and you know others in our realm are thinking about this, and but until they become the victim, because I'm going to best like you, every time you've done a victim notification, there's not a one of them that said, "Well, it was my turn. I figured it happened eventually, so it's good that I got it out of the way." None of them expected to ever be a victim, right?
It's true. Yeah, it's true.
Right. So,
but there's also too. Right. The incentives in cybercrime, too, are just incredibly misaligned to attack this problem. Like if you think about it, right, in like Internet of Things devices, mm-hmm. right? If you have, you know, IoT device manufacturers who don't put any security in their devices whatsoever, and all of those devices are with consumers, right? Like your smart light bulbs, your coffee pots, your doorbells, whatever, are all harnessed, you know, to create a massive botnet that does incredible damage to some sort of organization, like the IoT device maker is not going to pay a price from their angry consumers right. that happened.
Yep.
Right. So there's that also. I will say that was another thing that I thought was really interesting on the Hill, right? There are plenty of people on the Hill who are absolutely savvy about the implications of the cyber threats that we're facing, the national security implications of all of that. Mm-hmm. But there's no cybersecurity lobby, and there's no cybersecurity like voting constituency. Right. There is no one who's rattling anyone and saying, "Hey, this is important." I mean, at a voting block, at a constituency or a lobbying level.
Well, the problem is that cybersecurity is a loss. It's a loss to any company. You can't make money off it unless you're a cybersecurity company. You do, but obviously, you know, the CrowdStrikes and the Mandiants are making money. But if you are, you know, Joe's clear defense contractor, that's just going to cost you something. Right. So, yeah.
Right. Well, exactly, and your cybersecurity defenses. You know, protect you, but your vulnerabilities also hurt others.
Oh yeah.
right? Oh, like what you do in the cybersecurity realm either hurts or helps other people, right? Like I tell people this all the time with ransomware, right? As soon as you have a victim of ransomware, whether they decide to pay a ransom or not, like they are most likely a victim because 36 other companies in their industry have paid a ransom before them.
Right. Yep.
And if they decide not to pay a ransom or mitigate or give us enough information to investigate or whatever, right, all of the information that the current targeted company has and gives up and tries to help is going to help future victims. It's not going to help them.
And I think that's where OFAC was trying to go with their list about if you pay a ransomware group, you're going to get about how they enforce that's beyond me. But that's a conversation for another podcast down the line. So let's have some humorous. Well, let me ask you. I'm sorry. One more question since you brought up algorithms. Stuff. Did you watch The Social Dilemma on Netflix?
I did.
And what's your 2-minute review or thought on what was said in that?
I agree that there's right that we have this sort of exploitation of human psychology going on, right? Mm-hmm. So right now the engagement algorithms, as they made the point in The Social Dilemma, right? The engagement algorithms feed off of the human psychology of anxiety and fear and anger.
Yep.
Right. And I worry about that too, right? Like I worry about our divisiveness and polarization and violence and all of that. None of this is going to stop unless we start adjusting those algorithms.
Right. Oh, absolutely.
You know what I mean? Yep, like, sure. Like this is just like, we're just the topics will change.
Yeah, I mean,
that's it. And I don't know. It's an exhausting way to live.
Absolutely, right? Tomorrow's going to be crazy. Exhausting. I'm just going to watch YouTube videos on 80s stuff tomorrow, and this, you know, a lot of Van Halen tomorrow. But let's go. So FBI favorite FBI headquarters story. There, being at FBI headquarters, there's a lot of stupid stuff that goes on, a lot of humorous stuff that goes on. I know my favorite story has to do with men's health, but we'll keep that for some other time. But so
you should explain that story.
maybe I will another time. But what is your favorite FBI headquarters story? It can be funny, sad, disappointing, enlightening, however you want to go with it.
Gotcha. So I have to tell you, because I'm talking to you, one of the things that immediately comes to mind is probably one of my favorite stories from when I was managing part of the cyber criminal program at headquarters, and one of my agents, who claimed to not drink that much, if at all, ever, drunk dialed me from Moscow to tell me that he loved his job and also that Snoop Dogg was hanging out in the lobby of his hotel, which he thought was really cool.
Well, that guy.
Oh no! Wait, that guy's an idiot. That was you, Darren.
Clearly, that guy's an idiot. But Snoop Dogg was hanging out in the hotel because he was doing a concert there. No, he was. You can ask anybody who was there because Andre Cicero of the New York office walked up to him with his creds and said, "Hey, I want to have a chat with you," and showed him his FBI creds, and the guy just laughed. It was funny. We were on our way to do more drinking.
Fantastic.
Yeah, but I will say,
out of all the people who ever worked for me, Darren, you were the only one who ever drunk.
Well, yay for me.
You.
But I will say, up until then, 2007. So 2007 was that? No, that trip was in 2008. Excuse me. So 2008, I had probably not had drink any alcohol in easily 16 years. Because I just didn't like it, but when you go to Russia, you are forced to. The Russians make you drink with them, and we would have these little glasses that they put vodka in. And I would get down to the bottom of it. I'm thinking I'm almost done, and then some stupid freaking waiter would come over and fill it up with more. And I'm like, come on, man. Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah, there's a lot of those. My best Russian stories have to do with vodka, but it is what it is. I have been to the Hermitage 3 times. I have not seen it sober once. So, but that's not my fault. That's the Russians' fault. It's all the Russians' fault. So my final question, I ask everybody this question. Go back in time. What would you tell your 13-year-old self?
Oh, man. So, say, career-wise, I would say I wouldn't change a thing, right? Like, I've absolutely loved everything I've ever done, right? Including learning some valuable lessons from the not-so-great parts, right?
Right, sure.
From the dips and the down parts of my career. So I guess the only thing I would tell my 13-year-old self is to quit smoking, because in 5 years it's going to suck when she goes to boot camp. That's really what I would tell my 13-year-old self.
Did you quit at 18?
I did not. I quit at 22.
Okay. I was going to say, because I never saw you smoke. So that was, you were sort of clearly killed it for a while. So that's good. Your lungs probably say thank you. Well, Don, I greatly appreciate this. We'll have to, so as we go, if this podcast continues, I probably need more than 50 followers to get this rolling, but we're going to keep going. Well, I'll have you back we won't go into a broad run like we did today, but I thought you have a very compelling FBI story that most people don't have. So I really appreciate you diving in there and putting up with my questions. But what I'd like to do in the future is come up with a case and we talk about that case and just the intricacies of it, because I mean, the one thing I've talked about it once with a source that I had for a case I had, but we never really even got into the difficulty with dealing with headquarters. And like if you were like had the issues I had in the early 2000s, is they kept moving cyber management at headquarters to cyber terrorism division, back to white collar, back to cyber, back to terrorism, back to white collar. You never knew who your program manager was from one month to another. So things like that, just the inside workings of the bureau would be interesting, I think.
Yeah, no, I agree, right? And there's certainly a lot of that, right? The Bureau is a unique agency that a lot of people just don't get to see the inside of, right? And again, I would say throughout the years, I wish people could see more, right, of what we do. I wish they could see the dedication of the people. I mean, especially, honestly, in these past few years, right, where we've taken quite a few punches, I would really, really, I can't even tell you how just absolutely impressed I was with my last squad. I don't know. The people are fantastic, right? And I wish the American public knew more about the people who are working so hard for them.
And actually, maybe that needs to be the podcast.
Really, truly have their best interests at heart.
Talk about the good things
we do. Yep. That are committed to doing the right thing. No, absolutely. But I will say too, when you talk about cases and investigations and things, I mean, I was even thinking back, right, to prepare for this podcast about some of my cases, you know, with insider threats and things in Los Angeles, and you know, the takeaways and the lessons that the private sector can learn still apply, right, today. Sure. Mm-hmm. for some of the ins and outs and things that we dealt with.
Well, I appreciate you coming on, and I do appreciate I sent you the questions beforehand, so you kind of knew what I was going to talk about. I appreciate you not sending it back to me edited with green marks all over it. So, thank you for that.
I've got much calmer about that.
That's good.
In my old age, Darren.
Excellent. Well, Don, enjoy the election results tonight. I hope you have a good bottle of wine, and I hope you don't spend too much time on Twitter.
Thanks so much. I absolutely will. But it was fantastic to talk to you. It was good to catch up.
All right. Thanks. You too. So I want to thank you for listening to this podcast. Thank you to Donna Peterson for participating. If you have any questions you'd like me to address on future podcasts or topics you'd like to hear, please email me at Darren@thecyberguy.com. That's CYBUR guy.com. That'll be in the notes of this podcast. You can see it there if you need the email address. I also produce another podcast called College Soccer Nation with Ole Miss head coach Matt Mott and SMU head coach Chris Petroselli. They talk about a variety of different soccer topics as well as other things. Feel free to check that out. That's called College Soccer Nation. You can find both podcasts on all the normal podcast distribution sites. As you progress through your week, make sure you understand the threats that are attacking you, assess your online risk overall, and then proceed wisely. Thank you very much. Enjoy your week.